Our proceedings for this morning, I just wanted to publicly, on behalf of the panel and the court, thank the Court of International Trade and its Chief Judge Stansu for hosting our argument this morning. This is a first for our court. We've sat in New York before, but I believe never at this particular courtroom. So we're very pleased to be there, and we thank them very much. The first case for argument this morning is 16-2300 Olag versus DVA. Am I mispronouncing the name of your client?
It's Henry Oleg.
Oleg, okay. Mr. Love, please proceed whenever you're ready.
Okay, we supported counsel. My name is Michael Love. I'm from Washington. I represent Henry Oleg, an officer, police officer who used to work at the Veterans Medical Center in Spokane, Washington. Mr. Oleg's appeal is essentially based on the fact that he believes there was a lack of substantial evidence. He also asserts that the penalty of removal was not reasonable. Essentially, what you have here is a hearing that was held in Spokane, Washington in October of 2015. And then initially, then after that, for Mr. Oleg, after some of the charges were sustained in the court. Mr. Oleg...
Well, let me interrupt you there.
Yes.
Just the problem, it seems to me, or the difficult hurdle you have in this case, is that not only do we have substantial evidence review, but we've got a series of credibility determinations made by the administrative judge, which in many circumstances are virtually unreviewable. So you've got the testimony of some of the witnesses, including Officer Bright. How do you get past that hurdle in reversing the AJ's conclusion, findings and conclusions?
We would ask the court to seriously consider the decision of Chauvin versus Department of Navy at 38F3-563-566, which essentially states that sound reasons based on the records were contrary.
Speak up, counsel.
Yeah, we're having a hard time hearing.
Sound reasons based on the record for its contrary evaluation of the evidence. Essentially, what you have here is you have on the specifications of the charge of falsification, the first three. Essentially, what you have is you have the testimony of a single officer, Officer Bright, who, based on the evidence or lack of evidence, was not testifying from personal knowledge. He was making assumptions. And the court should have taken that. The ALJ should have taken that into consideration.
Was there any record any evidence in the record that Mr. Olag actually swapped keys with Officer Huffman Parent on any of the relevant days?
Mr. Oleg's testimony was that his explanation was is that he probably did.
His explanation was that it was done. That it was a practice. Was there any evidence in the record that he actually did it?
There wasn't any evidence in the record that he specifically said on that date he recalled swapping keys. There was also...
But there was negative evidence.
There was also a lack of evidence from the agency of having Officer Huffman Parent corroborate what Officer Bright had said. This is a very large campus. Officer Bright admitted on cross-examination.
So you have a lack of evidence on one side, and you have evidence which you say is questionable on the other side.
Right.
But given that the trier of fact is observing those two things, something that you say, well, it should have been corroborated, and something where there's absolutely no testimony the other way, why isn't that enough?
Well, I don't think it's enough because if you look at Evidence Rule 602, this is a he said, he said, with no corroborated testimony from the other officer that they could have elicited.
So doesn't it come down to an issue of credibility at that point? Who's telling the truth? You got it. He says, she said.
It comes down to an issue of credibility, but again, yeah,
and we can't. This going back to Judge Pro's question, we can't review the issues of credibility.
But under Chauvin, you can still reverse if what was assessed as far as credibility is simply contrary to the evidence.
Wasn't there some video showing that the squad car never moved from position during the time that he claimed he was out on patrol?
There is evidence, according to what Mr. Bright said, that he claimed that he saw. But the acting chief, Kinsfather, and this is very important because this entire case is filled with spoliation of evidence, evidence that was lost, evidence that the agency relied upon, that the agency at the hearing, the acting chief, Kinsfather, even admitted in the record, and this is at Appendix 130 and Appendix 131 of the record, he admitted that the critical documents were lost. He admitted that when they reviewed the video, he and Lieutenant Lopez, they couldn't make out anything, and that video then was later sent to HR, which they were supposed to produce and have part of the evidentiary file, and that was lost. And at the hearing, Sergeant Kinsfather, when asked the question whether there were serious issues as to whether Corporal Oleg had ever falsified any information, he acknowledged that there were serious issues on that. As far as falsification, he acknowledged that critical documents were lost, and the agency had the burden of proof. So based on that testimony, essentially what you have is you have one officer, Bright, but then his own acting chief is contradicting his assessment of that video, which, again, was lost.
So what you're saying is there's contradictory evidence.
There's contradictory evidence, and the agency has the burden of proof.
And the trier of fact has the opportunity to weigh the evidence.
They have the opportunity to weigh the evidence, and under Chauvin, we still believe under that particular decision that the board should have reversed, and we're asking the federal...
Well, you're relying very heavily on that opinion. What is the legal premise of that decision? What do you read the rule of that case to be?
What I read the rule of the case to be is that sometimes you can have a situation where someone sees a light and they think it's red, but the evidence is so contrary to what that person has evaluated that it simply makes no sense when you look at the totality of the evidence in the case, especially when you take into consideration the agency having the burden.
So you're asking us to glob those facts onto the facts of this case, and what if there's daylight? I mean, unless the two sets of facts are identical, I don't see why that precedent, you're using that precedent as if we're somehow compelled by that case to rule in one way in our case, and I'm not seeing it.
When you take Chauvin and then you look at the record, the entire record of this case, and the fact that Officer Bright is testifying from assumption and not personal knowledge, the fact that the other officer did not corroborate what Officer Bright was saying, and then most importantly, gives spoliation of evidence. You've got the acting chief, who, by the way, there was never any investigation that was done in this case. Neither one of those officers were ever interviewed. Corporal Oak, neither one of them was ever interviewed. And you have the acting chief under oath saying that there are serious issues, whether Corporal Oleg ever entered any false information into the battlefield chat. On the issue having to do with the sleeping on duty, Officer Oleg acknowledged, based on the nature of the shift, the fact that it's a night shift, that there may have been times that he had dozed off. The record is also clear, though, that at no time did he, in this break room, which, by the way, is a break room that officers use, it's not open to the public, the facility at night is entirely closed, and this incident of sleeping on duty, the other officers were in there when that occurred. That entire place is locked. There's no evidence at all that by dozing off on a couple of occasions, which he acknowledged, did he endanger either persons or property.
Couple means two?
Excuse me?
I said a couple means two.
Couple two, means two.
Two occasions? Because I thought it was more.
Well, there was about three occasions where they were sleeping on duty. He had not acknowledged on at least two out of the three that, yes, it looks like that he was dozing off based on the pictures of the cell phone pictures that they had taken. Important point, though, is that the agency acknowledged at the hearing, it's in the record, that other officers had also engaged in that behavior and that they had not been removed. The important point, looking at Downing, Americans with Protection Board case, is that with the lack of evidence as far as endangering persons or property, the penalty of removal simply was not reasonable. The other specification...
So there's a rule that you're not allowed to sleep on the job. And then you say that's only enforceable, or are you saying only enforceable with the penalty of removal if there is some negative consequence that results?
Well, if you look at the case law, and it talks about there has to be a nexus to support a removal of sleeping on duty, that somehow that as a result, that consequence of the behavior resulted in danger to either persons or property. And the agency acknowledged, and the board acknowledged that was not an issue.
So you can't discipline. You can't have a rule that says you can't sleep on the job,
you can't
enforce that rule unless something, heaven forbid, happens, and so therefore you say this caused that.
Right? No, you can enforce the rule. I didn't mean to say that, Your Honor. What I mean to say is that as far as going to a penalty of removal as opposed to a lesser penalty, you have to have that nexus there. And that's another part of our argument. Not only is Corporal Oleg saying there's a lack of substantial evidence, but that also the penalty of removal, if you look at the Douglas factors, was simply not reasonable. I would like to preserve some of my time.
Judge Raymond. Okay. Why don't we hear from the government? Thank you. Good morning.
May it please the Court, Farah Jonyam on behalf of the United States. The board properly weighed evidence and made credibility determinations before sustaining the charges of inappropriate behavior and sleeping on duty. Furthermore, the VA's decision to remove Mr. Oleg was reasonable. Now, in regards to the evidence that the administrative judge considered for the charges of inappropriate behavior, the administrative judge considered the testimony of Officer Bright, and she also acknowledged that Mr. Oleg had noted that he believed there was a credibility issue with this particular witness.
Counselor, how do you respond to your opponent's argument that the removal was unreasonable because there's no evidence of any type of endangerment to property or to people?
Yes, Your Honor. Now, the Downey case that Mr. Oleg's counsel referenced did note that if there was a first offense under the VA's table of penalties for sleeping on duty, then that may not necessarily be sufficient if there was not any sort of endangerment. And so in the Downey case, there was petitioner had been caught sleeping on duty.
But do you have to have a showing of endangerment? Isn't there... wouldn't sleeping on a job also be falsification of information that you worked X amount of hours, but yet you slept less than that, or you slept part of that?
Well, I believe the falsification charge has a different standard in terms of what the agency needs to show for preponderant evidence.
Counsel, move that mic a little closer.
Oh, I'm sorry. There's an intent component to the falsification, but the issue here in terms of the removal and
you need to move the mic over a little more.
I'm so sorry. Can you hear that now?
Yes. Thank you.
The issue here in terms of why Downey is distinguishable is that in the Downey case, there was one count of sleeping on duty. Here, the VA made very clear in its Douglas factor analysis that's in the record that the agency was also considering a number of other charges, most importantly, the seriousness of the falsification and the fact that there were multiple accounts that, taken together, they removed the appropriate...
So you're acknowledging if it were exclusively the sleeping on the job twice with no consequences, then looking at the other kind of cases the agency has had, perhaps under the Douglas factors, that would not be sufficient for removal.
It potentially would not be sufficient, Your Honor. The court would likely need to remand the case back to the agency to consider whether or not, for example, whether or not there were other similarly situated employees, and Mr. Oleg had offered evidence before the board that there were several other employees that were caught sleeping on duty but only received a reprimand, and the board and the agency distinguished those individuals because they did not have other serious allegations of misconduct. So if it was just sleeping on duty, there would likely need to be a remand. However, the agency made clear that when it was imposing the penalty, it was basing it in large part on falsification. And
that's pure speculation, because if it was just sleeping on duty, it might not have gotten anywhere until it got to 3, which you allege, or 4 or whatever. But at some point, sleeping on duty has to be enough.
That's correct, Your Honor. And My only point was that there could potentially need to be a remand just to reweigh the factors and to provide...
Well, under the VA table of penalties, it does provide the guidelines, right, for situations. And on the second offense of sleeping on duty, it's removal. There's no other penalty, just flat-out removal.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Were there, other than the incidents that we're dealing with in this instance, were there other prior incidents of sleeping on duty that he had been reprimanded for?
Not to my knowledge, based on the record, Your Honor. This was the first disciplinary misconduct that took place in the course.
Do we look at all the instances as disciplinary misconduct in this situation, or does there have to be prior instances? Because I'm looking at the table now, and for the first offense, it says 7 days or removal. So he could have been removed at this point. What's your position? Is this a first offense or second offense?
Well, it was three separate offenses, because they were three separate days, and so there would be three offenses.
That's what I was asking. So every day is a...
Yes, that's correct.
But he was not previously reprimanded for that first day. They're all treated in terms of penalty as one in this case.
That's true, Your Honor.
They were pretty close together in time, weren't they?
They were. They were all of the misconduct, both on the falsification and also the sleeping on duty, took place over the course of a single week. And so after he was found sleeping on duty by his fellow officers, they both provided written statements to the VA within a few days of the sleeping on duty. And so it was all sort of considered together because there was such a time frame.
And doesn't that suggest something other than a penalty of this guy had a pretty long and distinguished record, and when you have multiple occurrences but all occurring within a short period of time, does that not suggest that maybe some sort of counseling or something is going awry that would not necessarily compel a penalty of removal?
It doesn't, Your Honor, and this, under the facts of this particular case, the agency looked at a number of aggravating and mitigating factors, such as his prior history, but found that ultimately the seriousness of the offense was really what was important here. As a VA officer, he's a federal law enforcement officer. He can be called as a witness on behalf of the United States. His integrity is incredibly important. And the fact that there was falsification of official documents, and also that the falsification centered on whether or not he was conducting security patrols over the VA facility, the fact that he was not conducting these patrols could put VA personnel, patients, and members of the public at risk.
But he really was removed for sleeping on duty. I mean, he was actually removed for sleeping on duty.
He was removed for sleeping on duty and also...
And other aggravating circumstances were taken into account. But when I look at the table of penalties, it says, item 17, sleeping on duty, and then B, where the safety of patients, beneficiaries, members, employees, or property may be endangered. And here there's no proof of that.
That's correct, but he was also removed for the falsification. And in the board, or in the agency's Douglas factor analysis, they specifically state that given the combination of offenses and the egregiousness of the falsification of official records, they felt removal was appropriate. So it was for more than just sleeping on duty. If the court has no further
questions. I've got another question. Sorry. You seem to argue that multiple officers reported that he never had keys. But as I review the record, it's just one officer. I guess it was Officer Bright.
That's correct.
That testified about that. But when you read through Bright's testimony, there's really no foundation laid as to the basis for his testimony. Am I wrong about that? You understand what I mean about his testimony?
I do, Your Honor. There's a couple of things I want to point out on the record in regards to that. One, he did state on several occasions that he was confident and sure that there was no swapping of keys that night. But also there was a written statement that he provided to the agency earlier that's in the record as well. And in that statement, he noted that both he and Officer Huffman Parent were reviewing, they were in the system and they saw a number of entries pop up showing that Officer Oleg had, or stating that Officer Oleg had conducted searches and that they were suspicious of that. And now that wasn't fleshed out before the administrative judge, but there were no further questions on either from Mr. Oleg's counsel or from VA's counsel.
Yeah, but who's got the burden to flesh those things out? I mean, you've got a witness, you're relying on his testimony, and doesn't the foundation have to be laid by you all and not necessarily... I know what you're saying, and I understand that they could have come back on cross and tried to undermine him or asked about the foundation, but that's not their burden. It's yours, isn't it?
Well, the burden is that the agency does need to prove by preponderant evidence, and that's a reasonableness standard. And here they did offer testimony from an officer stating that there was no swapping of keys. That was not refuted. Mr. Oleg also had an opportunity in writing to refute that testimony after receiving the notice of proposed removal. And he did not at any point in time actually say, no, that's not correct. I did actually swap keys with one of the officers and did conduct controls. And so in that sense, the agency did meet its burden to show that it was preponderant evidence supporting the falsification charges.
And what about your friend's argument with respect to spoliation and the absence of evidence and the missing records? What impact, if any, does that have on the analysis?
There's little impact in this particular case, Your Honor. He's referring to, I believe, it's specification number 7. On a separate instance, he was also found to be falsifying records. And there, Officer Bright testified that he physically observed Mr. Oleg at a time that he was supposed to be conducting a patrol, which prompted him to review video surveillance. And yes, while the video surveillance was ultimately destroyed, he testified before the administrative judge that he had observed that footage. And in addition to that, Sergeant Kim's father, his supervisor, also offered testimony that's noted in page 30 of the joint appendix, that he also observed the footage. And so while, yes, the footage was destroyed, and it's unclear what exactly happened to it, there still was direct testimony from police officers indicating that they had seen the footage and that the police car did not move.
In the reply questioning of your opposing counsel, I'm going to ask if evidence comes in without objection, whether the trier of fact can consider it, even though it might be objectionable. So I want you to respond to that now, since you won't have a chance later.
Yes, Your Honor. I would note that the evidence can be considered. There was no objection lodged before the administrative judge, and there was no sort of objection lodged during the discovery process before the board leading up to the hearing. The court has no further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Love, you know my first question.
Well, I was there for the hearing, Your Honor, and we had the opportunity to cross-examine the witnesses.
Can you talk into the mic?
We didn't make a motion to strike or anything of that nature, that's correct. But
So the question was, then can the trier of fact then consider that since it's not deemed objectionable?
Well, I guess they can consider it, but what you're dealing with, again, is evidence of essentially assumption, again, and speculation. And
so you're talking about what my law professor used to say in evidence, that goes to weight and not admissibility.
Correct. But, again, this case, as the court was raising its questions to counsel for the government, there was no foundation that was laid for Officer Bright's testimony. He was their only witness. That was the witnesses they were relying
but
upon. They did not.
Foundation is an objection as to admissibility. And you've already conceded an admissibility.
That's correct, but it goes to our argument of lack of substantial evidence. I mean, they had an opportunity to have Officer Huffman Parent corroborate that, either in a sworn statement or in his testimony, and that was never done. And again, I come back to the fact that, and if you look at
what would corroboration have done in your view? I mean, why do you keep going back to that?
Because we're talking about a tipping of the scales.
No, we're talking about substantial evidence.
Well,
there's no scales there. The question is whether the evidence is sufficient. There's no tipping of scales. We're not measuring. You're not weighing evidence. That's not substantial evidence.
Well, if you take it from the context of, again, the agency has a preponderance of the evidence to prove these charges. And by having a single witness who then was not even corroborated by another officer and then was even had his own assessments of the evidence, not supported by the acting chief. As far as the video goes, In Appendix 129 to 131 of Chief Acting Chief Kinsfather's testimony, both he and Officer Lopez essentially admitted that the video was of such poor quality it was of no use. They couldn't see anything. And then, of course, the video is then subsequently destroyed after it's given to HR. So what you're left with as far as these specifications of alleged falsification, you've got an officer who had no prior history of issues about his honesty or integrity.
Did you have a sanctions motion?
I did not bring a sanctions motion.
That is, under the discovery rules, if there is spoliation of evidence, you can make a motion to have something taken as an admitted fact. You didn't do that.
Yeah, I had done that before in the context of in a jury situation, but we made the decision that we weren't going to do that since we converted from the Ministry of Law.
Right.
But if you look at the record, Appendix 129 to 131, the testimony of Acting Chief Kinsfather, it reveals simply the lack of substantial evidence as far as the falsification. You've got specifications where he's accused on three occasions of entering false information into the VAP DOJ. But that's based on evidence only from Bright that is making the assumption that on a Wednesday, when there's three officers on a very large campus, that there's no way that Hank Oleg and Officer Huffman Bright ever swapped keys. But he admits in his own testimony that could have happened. He doesn't know because the officers are not joined to the hip. They don't control the three of them together. And then the last specification on falsification charge is the video, which was destroyed, and Acting Chief Kinsfather admitted himself that it was of such poor quality it was of no use. So he contradicts the single officer Bright that the agency is relying on for the removal under the falsification.
How does that contradict?
How it contradicts is that Officer Bright says he viewed the video and that the car never moved at that time. Acting Chief Kent's father reviews the video and he says, well, it was such a poor quality, we couldn't tell what was on it. And the other important point is there was no investigation. Neither one of these officers were ever interviewed. And then when they went to make their decision as far on the penalty, they never considered progressive discipline, but yet progressive discipline was their practice. And they never took into consideration, they said they did, but they never took into consideration length of service, the fact that he was had exceptional performance evaluation.
You're not going to prevail. How can you possibly prevail on that argument? Even though they said they did, they didn't. If they said they did and they discussed it and they were under oath, then if your case rests on our believing you an attorney argument versus what was said in the record, that's a pretty high mountain to climb.
Well, it's in the record that the medical director, Ronald Johnson, testified that the practice was progressive discipline and they did not engage in progressive discipline.
Right. Okay, thank you. We thank both sides and the case is submitted.